Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Mormon Matters Podcast. I've got the Genesis team here. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon, along with David Bakervoy, Father Tom Roberts, and Brian Hauglid. Thanks, guys, for joining us again.
Great to be here.
Fantastic to be here with such a great team of guys and scholars.
Well, we won't take the time to reintroduce you guys here. Other than David, I know there was a couple things this week. I know your book's getting closer and closer to be out, but you also started a blog. Do you want to quickly punch that up?
Oh, sure. Thank you. Yes, I was invited to blog with Patheos, and so my blog is entitled When Gods Were Men, which is a play upon the Atrahasis line, and should be a fun experience. Looking forward to that, so thanks for drawing attention to it.
Great. Anybody else with any news this week?
My articles on academics.edu are drawing a great deal of attention.
Nice.
I wrote up an Aramaic commentary of the Lord's Prayer, and our Syriac and our Aramaic scholar loved it and wanted to post it on his website. So if anybody writes academic papers, we're all following each other on that website.
And so give it the website again.
Yes, it's academics.edu, and I've got 25 of my academic works up there, PhD dissertation, the master's dissertation on the Middle Eastern treatment of divorce and remarriage, commentaries on the Aramaic reading of the Lord's Prayer, and just all types of other things.
So just type in Tom Roberts, or what would somebody
and, well, search? Then it'll come up, and then you can post your own papers and list your own affiliations. So it's
nice.
Really quite an operation. It's read by 4 million academics around the world.
Awesome. Great. Thanks, Tom.
I think David and I are on that, too, I believe. I'm on it, I think, academia.edu.
I think you are.
Yes, because we follow each other. David, you're on there, aren't you?
I am. Yep. Good. I'm glad we brought attention to that. That'll be great.
No, I got a post.
I've been trying to talk you into it.
I know you have. Just too many other projects. But thanks. I'll probably throw my dissertation up and stuff. Thanks.
Well, are we all following each other? We should if we're the Genesis team.
Awesome. You guys are the team. I'm the the ringleader here, but I don't know anything. Anyway, I'm excited to be with you guys today, and we're going to begin with Abraham 12 and just work on Genesis 12, and we're going to go the best we can through the story of Abraham. We're going to leave out the Lot stuff and the Sodom and Gomorrah for this discussion. We'll pick those up another time, but we're going to basically go through the life of Abraham and hit some of the key things that are the major events, the things that have had legs that have influenced Christianity and Islam, as well as certainly Mormonism through the Book of Abraham and our emphasis on the covenantal process and things like that. So we'll focus on Abraham and all that stuff. But David, you suggested that maybe we just do a synchronic reading of just the story of the arc of Abraham's life as a way to kind of get us started, and then we'll come back and loop into the various pieces. So would you lead us in that?
I think that is a great way to start. Thank you for the invitation. This is exciting material. Our audience will be familiar with the basic story of Abraham. It's laid out synchronically. Let me define that term quickly. At the beginning of these broadcasts, we talked about a diachronic analysis, which would refer to looking for individual components within the structure of the books and how they developed over time. A synchronic analysis takes the fact that ultimately these individual documentary accounts have been brought together to create one specific narrative. So taking Abraham's life as portrayed in Genesis, reading it holistically would be another term. It begins in chapter 12, and it's laid out from a literary perspective, according to the covenant that God makes with Abraham. So we begin in chapter 12. Abraham's name is there, still Abram, and he's told to get thee, verse 1, out of thy country, from thy kindred, from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And then God, later on, is going to make this Abrahamic covenant to give Abraham two things, seed, meaning posterity, and land. And the way that this story, the life of Abraham, is structured in the book of Abraham is that God enters into the covenant, promises seed, promises land, and then we have a cycle that appears. There will be the covenant followed by covenant frustration, followed by covenant renewal, and then frustration once again, covenant renewal, and this happens all the way throughout his entire life narrative. And so to give an illustration of this, in chapter 12, right after in verse 7, that God makes the promise to give Abraham posterity and land, he goes to Canaan and immediately learns that he can't have the land because there's a famine. So it threatens that promise. So then he goes down into Egypt, and he, of course, has the episode with the Pharaoh, where he loses his wife, thus threatening his ability to have seed. He will then, as the narrative continues, return to the land in chapter 13 and build an altar, and the covenant is renewed. Then in what happens in chapter 13 is that there's the separation with Lot. And Lot, from an ancient Near Eastern perspective at this point, is the most logical individual to fulfill the patriarchal promise of posterity of seed, because he is in essence the adopted son. Remember, Abram does not have any children at this point. So Lot separates, thus threatening his ability to have seed. And he takes a good portion of the land, covenant frustration. But at the end of chapter 13, then, it's followed with covenant renewal. After the loss of Lot, after the loss of a major section of the land, we read in verse 14 that Yahweh, the Lord, said unto Abraham, look up, look at the land, southward, eastward, westward, northward. I give it the land to you and to your seed. So covenant renewal. Then chapter 14 is the battle with the kings. And from an ancient Near Eastern perspective, the purpose for going to war was to acquire land. So we as readers of the account, approaching it as an ancient audience would, we think, finally, he's going to be in the land, he's going to inherit the land because he's gone to war. But at the end, of course, we're frustrated as readers because he says, no, I can't take it from you, even though I've won this and you offer it to me as the indigenous population of Canaan. No, no, this must be given to me by God. So this pattern then continues throughout Abraham's life until he's finally in the land, and we get this cycle repeating over and over again until we get to chapter 21. Isaac is born. We think all is going to be happily ever after. And then we transition to the powerful narrative in chapter 22, where God then says, no, take your son, kill him as a sacrifice. So it's the cyclical pattern of covenant, covenant frustration, covenant renewal, covenant frustration that happens until throughout his entire life narrative, until finally then he's in the land, and we read after 22 that his wife, his beloved wife, dies. And then finally, I love the conclusion to the narrative in chapter 24, that after going through this entire difficult pattern of life's existence, we read, Abraham was old, was well stricken in age, this is 24:1, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things.
Nice.
May we all be so blessed, right?
Right.
with so much
thankful.
So I think that's a very helpful way to look at the general structure for the life of Abraham as it's laid out to us in the book of Genesis.
That is great. Any comments from Brian or Tom?
Just basically, in the general Christian tradition, the life of Abraham is, of course, seen as the basis of building the community of the faithful. You know, we often look back to him, you know, through the fathers of Israel, you know, for wisdom, the beginning of what it's like to be called. Some even look back, Genesis 14:20, to try to get, you know, tithing out of this from Melchizedek and, you know, other things sometimes I wish we wouldn't pull. And it seems that Abraham, along with Moses, seems to be the person who is magnified in all three of our religious traditions.
Yes, thank you. Brian, what's on your brain, especially anything from Islam?
Islam is doesn't really focus on the cycle as much as it focuses on more of a midrashic approach. So if you're going to get to the legends of the Jews or some sort of, mythicizing type thing where it actually focuses on Abraham as the perfect model, in a sense, of how to be a good Muslim. So it's mostly on example.
And it
intersperses all sorts of stories. Like Midrash likes to do. It likes to fill in the gaps. What don't we know about Abraham? Well, let's fill that in and see if we can. So it gets a lot into the birth of Abraham. It gets a lot into why Abraham is doing certain things, and all the way up into the sacrifice, of course. It doesn't follow the biblical text. It's following more of the Quranic approach there. That's kind of the long and the short of it.
Good. Well, and we'll hit the different pieces there, because even what you said, like two or three questions came up for me where I know it diverges, from some of this stuff. So, okay, I'm excited to do this. And Brian, we'll be using you probably in this next section a bit more for your work on the Book of Abraham and the Mormon takes on this. And so in both cases, we have God commanding Abraham to leave Ur, to leave the land of the Chaldeans, and to head eventually into the borders of Canaan, right? And Canaan is the promise of the promised land to them. Now,
hey Dan, can I just before we leave the Chaldeans and David and Tom, I want you to chime in on this because in the Islamic they have or at least in the apocryphal stories of Abraham, that he goes through a sacrifice in Ur of the Chaldees. And the Hebrew for Chaldees has been translated by, some of the rabbis and such as coming out of the fire of the Chaldees. Have you heard that before? And so that prompts these stories about Abraham being thrown into the fire. This is all in Muslim stuff now, but you can also find it in some Jewish legends about Abraham being thrown in the fire as he's fighting against Nimrod and against the idol worship and all this kind of thing. But it's tied in linguistically to Chaldeans. Any thoughts on that?
It is also in the Christian tradition, the Book of Rules from the early church, as we work through the Christian tradition, that's what happened.
It's interesting. I've read through Brian's book on Abrahamic traditions and lore that he published with the Maxwell Institute. So though I'm familiar with the folklore and mythology that's surrounding Abraham's sacrifice, and I'm not familiar with that wordplay, no.
Okay, Brian, in the Book of Abraham, it has him sacrificed on an altar, or at least he was, being offered up for that. Is this what you're saying? Is there's a longer, wider tradition of him being attempted to be killed either way, and the Book of Abraham goes with on the altar with the priests of Elkanah versus the fires? Is that kind of a...
Yes,
fair?
That's what I'm saying. We know that the Book of Jasher was around in the early 1840s. This is after, the Book of Abraham had already been done, especially chapter one, which was translated in 1835, which deals with the sacrifice. But the idea that you have a sacrifice going on in Ur of the Chaldees before Genesis 22 sacrifice is very intriguing. It gives you this sense that Abraham not only has a sense of being the father of a son who experience of being the one who's about to be sacrificed. And we can talk more about this in when we get to Genesis 22.
Right.
But the idea that the Ur of the Chaldees sort of has this play on words, that there was some sort of a sacrifice or something happened to Abraham where he had his life threatened, is very intriguing.
Interesting. And do you know if were there any other wider traditions any of you are aware of that it was his father who was sort of a worshiper of Elkanah and was maybe kind of instrumental in his son being the chosen one to be sacrificed?
Yes, there is one called the Commentarium in Gignisium that actually upholds that idea that there was sacrifice that began with Abraham's father, and it said he did not worship the fire, but actually, you know, performed a sacrifice. So these traditions do seem to be varied, don't they? And quite broadly used in the ancient world in different ways.
Awesome.
But the sacrifice of Abraham is pretty widespread out there. It's in Christian, Jewish, Islamic, and to me that is saying something must have happened. Okay. And then, of course, the Book of Abraham picks up on that in a different way. He's got him on an altar, and so he's not being thrown into this fire and turns into a nice pool, you know, and this kind of thing. And he's conversing with angels, and, you know, there's all sorts of stories about that. But anyway, enough of the Midrash.
Okay, well, I'm fascinated. So somehow his father may or may not have been involved in this wider tradition, but Abraham says, I'm leaving. He says, I'm taking my brother and my brother's son. So his brother is named Haran, H-A-R-A-N. How do you say it? Haran? Haran?
Haran, yeah.
Haran. So his brother is Haran, and Haran's son is Lot, right? And then his father is Terah, T-E-R-A-H, and he comes along too, but apparently in the early going, at least in the Book of Abraham here, Terah says, I'm not going further, I like the lands and I like the flocks and the place that I've got here, and then it says that the father went back to his idolatrous ways. Is there anything wider tradition than the Book of Abraham on all that?
Some have suggested the term Terah, and the other fellows will have to fill in other directions. But Dr. Wilmington, one of my professors, said that the term Terah meant to delay, and that he's acting out in the narrative what he actually did in the story.
Oh, interesting. Again, so people fulfill their names in the ancient world.
Yeah, the technical term that scholars often use for that is name causation. And we see this, yes, indeed, as Tom's pointed out, we see this all through Genesis. We see it, one of the best examples of this is the name Jacob, Yaakov, which is coming up in our study, which technically means trickster. So, everything in his life involves trickery. He is,
yes.
You know, until he gets his name changed to Israel, one who, you know, prevails with God.
Awesome. Yeah, that is such interesting material. Okay, so Haran is his brother's name. In the Book of Abraham, they also name the land, or it says the land is so designated Haran, where they head to first. Is that a Joseph Smith addition, or
Let me address that, if I might. What we have happening in the Book of Abraham here is, when you do a kind of a side-by-side with Genesis 12 and Abraham 2, which are complementary of each other, you find a few things that kind of, definitely the Book of Abraham departs from the text, the KJV text on. You have Haran in Genesis dying, and you don't know why. In chapter 1 of Abraham 2, you have Haran dying in the famine. And so you get some explanation happening there. Same thing with going to Haran, and, you know, we could probably talk about, you know, where was Haran? Was it in the north? Was it in the south? But I don't know if you want to go there. But we go to the land of Haran, and this is where the land is denominated Haran. Probably, I guess it would be in memoriam of the Haran that died in chapter or verse 1. And,
is this akin to like Lehi saying we call this valley Lemuel and, you know, and the river? Is it like that? Do you think it's just a family designation?
It could be. I don't know for sure. But it could be something like that. And that's why you're getting some chronology here from verse 1 to verse 4 in Abraham, and Haran's already gone. I don't know, maybe the other two gentlemen can chime in on this, but I haven't been able to figure out another explanation for that.
Well,
I'm not sure we can either.
Well, the one question it brought up for me is, like, you get a sense that Abraham and his dad and this family is pretty prominent. It's certainly in the upper crust or whatever of their society in Ur. Would there have been a possibility that the dad was some sort of governor or whatever and would have the chance to name surrounding lands after his son or anything like that?
It's possible, yeah. By the way, I need to make one correction if I can. Maybe you can, you know, fix this on this podcast. But when I said Ur of the Chaldees, the play on words, and maybe this will make more sense to David now and Tom, Ur is the word that's playing on the word fire, okay? Not Chaldees. Chaldees is the astrology part, okay?
Okay.
Okay, thank you. That makes a great deal of sense. Okay.
Yes, yes. So we might have to fix that. I don't know how, but...
Read action.
Yeah, that's right.
I either will or I won't. We might have this very exchange still on the podcast. But thank you, Brian, on that. All right. So what I'm trying to do here, guys, is Mormonism, of course, has this Book of Abraham. It's got similarities and differences, and I just want to try to pull out to see if Joseph Smith's drawing, or is there some solid stuff here that at least is in the wider legends and mythology there. So.
There is a Haran. There is another Haran that they go to, and you have a northern Haran in southern Turkey, and then you have the Mesopotamian Haran in southern Iraq. And so you do have some Harans there. Now, I'm not sure still what Abraham 2:4 is, you know, referring to as far as, because it says the land which we denominated, we named it.
Right, that's kind of what I thought that meant.
Yeah, and so... what does that mean?
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. And I know that when we get to the sister wife thing, the Haranian stuff comes in terms of some of their customs, right?
Exactly. And
yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, then let's. He's on his way out of here and he's heading into Egypt eventually. So go ahead, David.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, we should definitely pick up for just a minute on the fact of that Brian brought up Ur and what that means, because that has been a discussion in LDS scholarship, and a lot of our listeners will be familiar with some of these arguments. There have been a couple of LDS scholars at BYU who have attempted to identify Ur, which is referenced in the biblical account as Abraham's homeland in Genesis chapter 11, Ur of the Chaldees, Genesis chapter 11, verse 28, with a northern Turkey site and location. And the reason for this is because it would provide greater legitimacy to the Book of Abraham. But we should acknowledge the fact that that is something that is just, that runs definitely against the grain in terms of scholarly consensus. The Hebrew here in Genesis 11 is Kasdim, and it identifies Ur with southern Mesopotamia. It seems to be very, very clear that this is the case. The passage of Genesis here, it derives from the priestly source of the Pentateuch, which we discussed in previous broadcasts, was written during a time specifically when that designation, Kasdim, was well known for ancient Babylon. So one would be hard-pressed to find a scholar these days outside of, you know, a couple at BYU that try to argue for a northern Ur location. And I think we need to draw attention to that because it's important, I think, for the structure, at least as, I mean, whether it is northern or southern, is not so important as the fact that, from my perspective, if we understand what the text is indicating in the Bible in terms of a southern Mesopotamian location, because then it becomes a reverse of the exilic experience of the Jews, right? And it ties into this idea of a Mesopotamian Babylonian focus that we find all throughout Genesis, and it's been the focus of our conversation throughout these broadcasts.
Can I just say that the Haran of the South is definitely supported by most biblical scholars, no question about that. But there is actually a Haran in southern Turkey. It's called Shanli Urfa that I've actually been to, and they have rich stories going way back, I guess, about Abraham being born there or being born around there. And it's just very interesting. Of course, that's not anything that scholars would take as absolute, you know, evidence or anything, because those are stories. But so you just get this tension between the southern and the northern Ur's going on there. But you're right. There's scholarly consensus is on
the That's right. The northern theory seems to be pulled from J.R. Dumelow in his 1904 commentary, which just follows the northern route, because he said it didn't have to be, you know, in southern Iraq, and then they seem to tie it back to Deuteronomy 24 and 26, where they thought Abraham went to the north at the time, you know, to rescue Lot and get 318 servants and all of that. And today, almost no scholar supports that, just like our gentlemen are saying.
Yeah. Just to draw our audience's attention then to the respected Anchor Bible Dictionary, Volume 6, which is on Ur, that I like to try and cite for those who get confused on this topic. The author makes the observation that after Babylon, Ur, in Genesis chapter 11, is without doubt the best known Mesopotamian site in the Bible because of its connection with Abraham and so forth. And that's pretty strong language, and it does reflect the fact that, you know, wherever he was born, the Bible wants to link him with the southern Mesopotamian origin and homeland.
Awesome. Okay. Thank you. All right, so he's on his way to Egypt, and this is where he gets the major articulation of the covenants. So, David, would you give a little more detail then on the two covenants, the seed and the land, and then let's kind of explode this into Mormon land and what we do with the promises to Abraham?
Good. Well, yeah, and the reason I phrased it that way is because really what we understand as Latter-day Saints by the Abrahamic covenant primarily derives from the book of Abraham, where we're going to read about priesthood, we're going to read about the idea that the Savior, the Messiah, will come through his lineage, all of these wonderful things ultimately tied into, of course, with exaltation and eternal life. Those who become the children of Abraham receive those blessings. Those are not part of what we find specifically in the Genesis account, so these are additions that we receive through the prophet Joseph and that scriptural text. In terms of the Bible, going back to what I said at the beginning of the podcast, really the Abrahamic covenant comes down to these two fundamental promises. He will receive land, and he will receive seed or posterity, and the two actually tie in with one another. What good is it to have land if a person doesn't have posterity to bequeath it to? But on the other flip side of that, what good is it to have a lot of children but not to have a place to put them in and give them the land?
So it's all verse 7 of chapter 12 of Genesis. This is where you get what you're just saying, and that's the Abrahamic covenant there?
Well, the Abrahamic covenant is laid out in a couple of different places. And going back to the synchronic study, we have different versions of it in P. We have different versions of it in J. But yes, these are all tied together now in terms of a holistic approach, and they will ultimately focus on the same two concepts, land and seed, from a biblical perspective. It's in the book of Abraham that we gain all of these wonderful additions that we have as Latter-day Saints into what the Abrahamic covenant means and how it applies to us.
Okay, so again, 12:7 is very, very minimal. Where are the others? So there's no hint at all? But give me some of the wording of the various places that it is spread out through Genesis.
Well, for example, chapter 12, verse 7 that you referred to, we read, "The Lord appeared unto Abram and said, unto thy seed," quoting the King James Version, "will I give this land." And there he built an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him.
So clearly a covenant being made there. Okay, what else?
One of the things that's always struck me is the Lord is always appearing to Abraham. You know, at the tents of Shechem and in other places, and he speaks to him, you know, face to face, you know, to make the covenant, you know, as the idiom has it, and like a friend. And There's a lot of discussion in Christian theology on who appears in Genesis 18, and I hope we can get there. Because to me, it's partial proof that our Lord can use a corporeal body in appearing to all these people.
Mm-hmm. Mm, interesting.
So, yeah, so for example, then, as we just moved through that pattern of covenant frustration, covenant renewal, you know, we move into chapter 13, where we'll read in verses 14 and 15 and 16 that the Lord will say unto Abram, look up, look at the land northward, southward, eastward, westward, verse 15, all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever, and I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth. And in terms of their numbering and so forth. So we're
well, that's, you know, at least a hint that Abraham picks up, the book of Abraham picks up, right?
Sure.
About the numerousness of the posterity, yeah.
Yep. And later on we're going to read, and Abraham's posterity will not only be connected with the dust of the earth in Genesis, but also with the stars of heaven, which is interesting for its typology and connections with the book of Abraham.
And these promises in Genesis 37 through 49 are in large due to this action, aren't they? There's a direct connection.
Absolutely.
The book of Abraham itself, at least verses 9 through 11, seem to be an expansion of Genesis 12, 2 and 3. I mean, you can actually, if you put them side by side, you can actually see where the expansion is taking place.
Great nation, bless thee, name great, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Bless them that bless thee, curse them that curse thee. Okay, so I'd missed that when my eyes went on to 7, so you're right. That seems to me to be the most direct. Yes, awesome,
and,
Brian.
And you get a little bit of land in verse 6 of Abraham, chapter 2, where it talks about, I have purpose to take thee away out of Haran, and to make of thee a minister to bear my name in a strange land, which I will give unto thy seed after thee for an everlasting possession. So you get a little bit of land there at the beginning. Then you get the author of the covenant introducing himself in verse 8. My name is Jehovah. And then we get into the covenant from there. The expansion.
Awesome. Yeah, that is great.
And Brian uses the term expansion, which I think is appropriate in light of the textual evidence. And we should interject then and state that it is an expansion of these biblical sources. And remember from our previous discussions, these are separate documentary sources produced by Judean scribes. For example, you know, Genesis chapter 12 that he referred to originally is J. And so indeed... And I know Brian wasn't necessarily intending to go that direction, but if we accept that these are expansion of biblical sources, it makes it very difficult to connect this material literally with Abraham in terms of authorship.
Right. Yeah. Maybe we'll do another podcast another time on the whole Book of Abraham stuff. It's been done by John DeLynn and others, so I haven't done it on my podcast, but it might be important to do down the road.
I think it's overdue.
Okay.
Based on what we know now, we know more now than we did even then. So in those earlier podcasts.
Okay. Well, good. Well, then we'll schedule it. I bet my audience will be excited. Okay.
Good
so
stuff.
Yeah. All right. So let's do the Abraham 9 through 11. Abraham 2, 9 through 11. And Brian, why don't you just lead us through stuff that clearly is new versus stuff that sort of has precedent in Genesis.
Okay, let me just start with, okay, I'll kind of highlight what is the Genesis 2 and 3 stuff. So we'll have, I will make of thee a great nation, I will bless thee above measure, and then here's where the expansion begins, and make thy name great among all nations, and thou shalt be, I better get Genesis 12 next to me here. But if you look at Genesis 12, verse 2, I will make of thee a great nation. Then there's some expansion. And I will bless thee, sorry. And then there's the expansion is above measure. There we go. It's above measure that the expansion is. And I will make thy name great is Genesis. And then there's more expansion among all nations. That's the expansion. And then thou shalt be a blessing is Genesis. And then here's more expansion. Unto thy seed after thee, that in their hands they shall bear this ministry and priesthood unto all nations. So can you see what's happening there? I mean, it's actually using the words of Genesis and then expanding on that. And then verse 3 picks up in verse 11. So you get a whole new verse here in verse 10 of Abraham. That's not in Genesis at all. Okay. And then you get, that's all expansion there. So that's continuing on with the expansion that had started earlier. And then you go to verse 11, and then that's bringing verse 3 back in, where I will bless them that bless thee and curse them that curse thee. And then you get that huge expansion that deals with the priesthood being the seed of Abraham, and the priesthood being the priesthood seed of Abraham and the literal seed of Abraham, or the seed of the body. And so it's just major expansion going on here, you know, that you're not getting in Genesis at all, really.
Okay. Now, Tom, the question for you then is any of these things that we're calling expansions, are they floating out there?
Absolutely. Even if we go back and look at Hebrew, you know, poetry, you know, the idea of covenant blessing, right, is that the nations of the earth will be blessed due to Abraham, that Abraham would inherit all of this and pass it through Isaac and Jacob, and that Israel would be a blessing to the nations. Clear up into the New Testament, in Hebrews chapter 1, we actually see Abraham referred to, you know, as an heir, you know, of this world, that is passed on through all of Christian tradition. So I think the expansion, at least as salvation history unfolds through Judaism and through the Middle East, and the blessings that are to go to the Arab peoples as well, you know, in Genesis 16, I think it's all about expansion and birthright and blessing.
And what about the priesthood and this distinction between literal seed and priesthood seed?
You know, in Christian theology, that would come much later due to the doctrine of adoption, you know, that we're adopted into the seed of Israel. We're adopted into, you know, the birthright and the covenant blessing. That's how most Christian expositors would look at that. So we receive the same promises that Hebrews chapter 1 would be taken out of Genesis 37 and so forth.
Okay. So Mormons aren't the only ones that go that way. That's good to hear. Okay.
Yeah, that's Brian. Right. Yeah. From an LDS perspective, of course, what you're seeing here is the seed of the priesthood, of course, or the seed in thy priesthood, meaning, you know, that the Abrahamic, the patriarchal priesthood of Abraham gets passed down through the generations. That's distinct from the literal seed, or the seed of the body. And that's what you get apparently in our patriarchal blessings, where you're getting that lineage declared. And so you have two different things going on there. And so it's very interesting.
Well, just to piggyback then on what Brian said, from a Latter-day Saint perspective, I like to share with that, with an LDS audience, the idea of the Abrahamic covenant. And as important as that patriarchal blessing is in terms of identifying tribes because of specific blessings that are given and assigned that way, I think the most important thing is to be identified as an heir to the Abrahamic promises, and therefore as an Israelite, if you will, one who prevails with God.
Nice.
Yeah, very good.
You know, guys, this Abrahamic covenant thing has, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, early in my faith journey, I, you know, accepted all this and everything that we've said here, just it worked for me so well. And then I had one of my most spiritual experiences, really, one of my neat spiritual experiences came just 8 years ago, because it was two cycles ago with the, you know, the Sunday school class, where I'm sitting in the Tooele 29th Ward, and they were discussing the Abrahamic Covenant, and I kind of went out of my body a little bit in terms of, like, I was sort of, you know, wasn't really in the discussion, but I was kind of observing the discussion, and it was like this firecracker discussion among, like, dozens of people in this Sunday school class of how much they felt blessed by this Abrahamic Covenant, and knowing that they were part of this, and all these biblical promises and things were in their lives and stuff like that. And I just had that really kind of peaceful moment where I just said, you know, I haven't thought about the Abrahamic Covenant in years, you know, because I'd been wrestling with everything else for so long. And I go, you know, to think it's, you know, and it was one of those moments where, you know, kind of when you have a certain amount of scholarship or whatever, but under your belt, where you say, I'm usually kind of thinking both inside the story and outside the story at the same time. In other words, I say, okay, if I can see the people here, they're inside the story, and yet I'm usually with my critical distance, you know, thinking outside the story a little bit and stuff. And I don't know, just this really beautiful peace came upon me, and it just sort of, that was like a turning point for me, where I became much more happy to think within the story along with my Latter-day Saint fellow members. And I, you know, I still, of course, always have in my brain what I know from certain scholarship things and, you know, critical thinking and all that different stuff. But it was with this Covenant of Abraham thing, and just the beautiful way that it was helping my friends, you know, in this ward, it was a really neat transition point for me. So I just didn't want to pass by.
It's a beautiful concept. Could I interject something from the general Christian tradition, and ask our team to respond that what I said later, you know, about the adoption of many sons and things like that, that wouldn't necessarily in salvation history go against or cause tension with what the Latter-day Saint sees here internally, would it? Because what happens downstream in the New Testament church, we would all share in those blessings, I assume. Could the team comment on that? Is there an intersection between where I said the general Christian church goes with this, with the adoptions of sons and daughters, you know, all over the planet due to the new covenant, you know, versus where the LDS internally go with it? Seems like we could still end up in the same place together.
I think I'll maybe jump in on this one. I think the intersection for Latter-day Saints and how we perceive the Abrahamic Covenant, I think we're still kind of following the way that Bruce R. McConkie put it years ago, and that's through ordinances. So that baptism would be kind of the gate into the Abrahamic Covenant. I mean, even though you have the blood of Abraham in you, in an LDS sense, you're not really in the gospel, in this circle until you've been baptized. And then once you've been baptized, you're in a sense in this Abrahamic Covenant. But that's not all. There's another ordinance. That's another kind of gate to a deeper entry into the Abrahamic Covenant, and that's temple marriage. And so once you have temple marriage, there are certain blessings that are pronounced upon you that relate directly to the Abrahamic Covenant. And so that's kind of where I think, you know, we as LDS members kind of come from on the Abrahamic Covenant and how it brings us into being adopted as sons and daughters of God. We become more, I guess we get closer to Him in a sense as we go through these ordinances. Does that make sense? Am I saying that right?
I think you expressed that exactly right in terms of the general LDS perspective that we hold. We could refer our listeners, and even Tom, because of his interest, to the LDS Bible Dictionary under the Abrahamic Covenant. And I'm not looking at it, but as I recall last time I read it, it definitely has, you know, McConkie's imprint on it. And it talks about the fact that Abraham first receives the gospel through baptism, which is the covenant of salvation. and then through celestial marriage, which is the covenant of exaltation. And that then, from our perspective, is those, yeah, Brian expressed it, those ordinances are directly tied to becoming heirs of the promises that we associate with Abrahamic covenant.
Thanks, guys. Anything more on the covenant here? Because I want to go into the strategy in Egypt to keep Abraham from being killed.
The only thing I would add to that most Catholics don't realize that in the old Orthodox tradition, when you have a sacramental marriage, after your baptism, that we go through the binding of the hands. My wife and I have done this in front of a priest, and your relationship is actually sealed for time and eternity, even in some Catholic traditions. This is written about from St. Vladimir's press a lot, and oftentimes it goes unnoticed by the general church membership.
Wow.
That's beautiful, Tom.
Wow.
That's beautiful.
Amazing. Amazing.
Maybe before we jump to the sister-wife thing, it'd be a good time to just interject quickly the idea of the name change in connection with covenant.
Because oh, good, still, yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, too, from an LDS perspective. So we find in chapter 17 of Genesis that Abram's name is changed to Abraham. So Avram in Hebrew is typically interpreted as exalted or high father, and with the addition that God gives of Avraham, it's interpreted as, you know, from as something like father of a multitude, something along those lines. And, you know, Sarai's name is actually changed to Sarah as well, but that's so, not so much a change in meaning as much as it is a change in pronunciation. Either way, the name change seems to be tied in with the concept of covenant. And
right.
As I teach this to an LDS audience, I like to give an analogy of a pet dog. I know that sounds bad, but follow me for a second. So imagine, you know, you find this animal and there's no collar on it. And you put up flyers and go to the Humane Society and nobody claims this dog. And, you know, he had a name before this experience, but you decide to keep him. And therefore, whatever his name might have been in the past, because he now belongs to you, you give him a new name, or even
actually,
this literally happened with my family. We've got this little terrier, and we adopted him from the Humane Society. His name was Toby, but now that he's ours, now that he belonged to us, my wife wanted to change his name to Ginkgo. So he has the name Ginkgo. You know, she's a fan of these trees and a Ginkgo biloba, and so he's Ginkgo, and he answers to that now because he's ours. We possess him. So this seems to be an idea that we can link with in terms of what's happening to Abram. And Abraham and Sarai and Sarah, a name change signifies the fact that God possesses them, that they belong to him. They have a covenantal relationship, and he has the right to name them with all of the power that a name invokes and has. As Tom has suggested in this ancient Near Eastern society, it even affects the course of your everyday action, as Tom has explained. So.
Love it.
And that's part of the reason, as a priest, we often have a name change. In Catholic tradition, it will sometimes come with confirmation, or it can come with ordination much later.
Yeah. I have a friend who converted from Christianity to Baha'i faith, and he went from Conrad to Kenneth at that moment, and I know it's isn't it something in Islam too? I know it seems like, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and all those different things, Brian, right?
Yeah, yes. When you have people convert to Islam, sometimes they'll change their name to, you know, something like Abdullah, you know, servant of God. You know, they'll change their names. Absolutely, kind of mark that significant transformation that's gone on in their life. It's interesting that in the book of Abraham, you get the name Abraham throughout the whole thing, even though where its counterpart, its intertextual counterpart in Genesis is still with Abram. And interestingly, back in the first, you know, publication of the book of Abraham in the Times and Seasons in 1842, March of 1842, it's Abram. and it gets changed later on to Abraham in subsequent publications, and they're just stuck with what we have now. And so, just a little sideline there.
No kidding.
And that name change is foreshadowed right at the beginning of the Abraham cycle in chapter 12, in the first promise that God gives. I will make of you a great nation. This is chapter 12, verse 2. I will bless you. I will make your name great. So it foreshadows the change from just a high father to Avraham, father of a multitude. And then picking up on that there, boy, there are lots of references all throughout the Hebrew Bible where a similar idea is expressed. One of the ones I like to refer to is Isaiah 56, 4 through 5, which reads, in regards to those who take hold of the covenant that God gives Israel, even unto those who take hold of the covenant will I give in my house, in his temple, and within my walls. And then the King James Version says a place. But literally it says, I will give within my house, within my walls, a hand and a name better than of sons and of daughters. I will give them an eternal name.
Nice. Okay, this is a troublesome passage. Abraham says, hey, we're going into Egypt, and Sarah, you're beautiful. Or she's Sarai by this point, I guess. You're beautiful. They're going to kill me because they want you, they want to possess you. And as a husband, I'm not going to be protected. But as my sister, or as you being my sister, that's a status that they will not kill me over this. And so a lot of people look at this as Abraham lying and things like that. What's the range of interpretations of what's going on here? At least the Anchor Bible helps me, at least think that there was a custom of when you marry somebody, you also adopt her as your sister, so this wasn't a full lie. So, David, why don't you lead us through, the overall stuff on this?
Yeah, good. I mean, full lie, partial lie, half lie, it's still a lie, right?
Okay, awesome.
I say that because it's intended to deceive the Pharaoh so that Abraham can survive. It's part of a pattern that we find in Genesis that scholars refer to as the wife-sister motif.
Get it with Isaac and Rebecca later, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and so in this instance that you're referring to at the end of chapter 12, this is traditionally ascribed to Jay, the Yahwist, and then it recur with King Abimelech in Pharaoh's place in chapter 20. But that particular wife-sister motif is traditionally ascribed to the E-sourced. And then with Isaac and Rebecca, instead of Abraham and Sarah, confronting Abimelech in chapter 26 of Exodus. And that one is again attributed to Jay. So no one documentary source repeats the story with the same couple and the same king, although they tend to draw upon this very similar pattern of deceiving some sort of official so that they can, escape death and, actually put the wife at risk. So it's a troublesome passage without question. The Book of Abraham actually, and Brian can comment more on this, of course, but the Book of Abraham is going to actually present this deception as a commandment from God. God will command Abraham in the Book of Abraham to make this deception. And, some critics have pointed to that and said, that's Joseph Smith perhaps trying to justify the things that he's doing at this point in terms of the deception and the start of plural marriage and things like that. And I just, it's an interesting connection historically that is sometimes pursued and talked about and discussed.
Some scholars have suggested that Abraham is fearing that, Sarai could be, thrown into the harem and actually, taken as a wife by the king, and he would lose her forever. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's the reality of the circumstance that he would face when we take this story literally and carefully. But I think ultimately, as it's introduced here, what we're really seeing is typology, right? So Abram's experience in chapter 12 with the Pharaoh, with the wife, it really pre-enacts the major themes of his descendants' experience at the end of Genesis and in the Exodus, right? So, for example, you have Abram's descent into Egypt because of a famine, which is precisely why the Israelites went into Egypt later in the end of Genesis. You have the death, or at least feared or death of the male, Abram, and then the children in Exodus, the male children in Exodus, and the survival of the female, which, and then you have also in this little the pericope discussions with Pharaoh, it uses the word plague, which is very interesting, that God plagued Pharaoh and his house. And then you have the release, and then perhaps the most important point to show that in addition to plague, that this is clearly intended as typology for the entire Exodus, you have the acquisition of great wealth, you know, which reflects the Exodus experience when the Israelites leave with the riches of Egypt in Exodus chapter 12, verse 35. So why I like to point this out then is because I think really that's what's going on. It's typology. It's representative of the most important event in the Pentateuch. The most important event religiously in the Pentateuch is not creation. It's really the Exodus. That's really where they're going to focus their attention. And so they're going to foreshadow this through the experience. And then I like this because my male feminist side comes out. And here you have Sarai, woman, therefore personifying God's chosen people, right? She, as woman, personifies Israel in this experience. And
even as a type of expansion of Eve in the narrative to some extent.
Interesting. Interesting.
So, Brian, David brought up the idea that it's God's idea in Abraham 2, versus here it seems like it's Abraham's idea in Genesis 12. Comment there if you want to, Brian, but somehow or other I want to let's double check this stuff that I'm getting from upper crust Haranian society, that there is sort of a higher status to brother-sister than there is to husband and wife. So let's at least bring in that too. But start however you want, Brian.
Well, that's kind of the crux of the issue. I mean, why is Abraham going to be killed more if there's more chance of him being killed as a husband rather than as not a husband? What's going on there? And then, of course, this, like David said, it's got to be there's something culture going on here, and of course, it's all very typological, but. You know, it is a conundrum, I think. There's some sort of a paradox going on there that it's kind of hard to unravel, you know, what's going on between Pharaoh and Abraham and Sarai, that he would actually take Abraham's life so that Abraham's got to deceive him into thinking that he's not married to Sarai, that she's just his sister, that they're just brother and sister. And then he's going to be okay. His life's going to be... is going to be spared, unless, like Tom said, you know, she's going to be pulled into a harem or something like that. And then if Abraham's in the way on that as a husband, then he's going to have to be killed off. You know, something like that is happening. But it's all very, to me, very much of a conundrum. As far as most of the texts out there, Jewish, Christian, what have Muslim even, they're always trying to defend Abraham. You know, Abraham is not ever going to be a liar in any of these stories. He is somehow going to be saved by, you know, the fact that we're all sons and daughters of God, you know, that we're all brothers and sisters in a gospel sense, that we're all, you know, that or if there's some cultural thing going on there, but Abraham definitely did not lie. Therefore, you know, what's going on there is totally appropriate. And if you don't understand that, then there's something wrong with you.
So, I'll piggyback on that and say, you know, I think we have a false paradigm when we're operating under the idea that lying is never the moral course of action, right? I like when I'm talking about this, I'll refer to students to, you know, imagine being a Christian family in Nazi Germany. And you're hiding a Jewish family there, and, you know, in your attic, and the Nazis come and they knock on your door and ask you, are there any Jews living here? What is the moral course of action there? We sometimes assume that lying is always wrong. One should never deceive. One should never tell a lie. And yet it's a little bit more complicated than that in terms of human interactions and what is the absolute moral course.
See, the earlier texts, they don't deal with it in that way. They don't look at it in that kind of a gray way. You know, they want to just, you know, save Abraham from having lying. And sometimes as Latter-day Saints, we want to do that too. I'm with you, David. I mean, I think it's much deeper than that. I mean, if you read the autobiography of Parley P. Pratt, you know, he does a lie in there, you know, that he totally justifies because it's going to save his life kind of a thing. And so there are times that we want to do that. But what Joseph Smith just turns that on his head, though. He's got God lying now, okay?
Right.
And that even makes it more, you know, problematic in some ways if you don't like to lie, you know?
And in the Old Testament, God did send lying spirits, you know, to throw battles and so forth.
That's a good point.
Okay, so is Spicer just wrong then in Anchor Bible where he talks about this Hurrian custom of at the time you marry somebody, you're also her sister? In other words, none of you guys have at least said that, so I'm just wondering if Spicer's out, is this one of the places where Anchor is really out of date?
Okay, yeah, let me comment on that because I absolutely love Spicer's commentary and his translation. I think it's absolutely wonderful, and in some ways, I don't know that it'll ever go out of date.
Okay.
As a translation, and some of his interpretations, including that, were based upon a premise that we could go back into ancient Near Eastern laws and find connections with what's happening in terms of the patriarchal narratives. And most contemporary scholars have abandoned that pursuit because of the dating of the documentary sources.
Okay.
But isn't there a question of anachronism there? That some scholars are bringing out with Hurrians and those kinds of things.
Exactly.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't believe that there's any evidence at all that Abraham was, that his story was taking a place at a time where this idea of I'm going to marry her as well as adopt her as my sister is happening because of their timeline.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think we can follow Spicer and make that connection. And again, remember, referring back, we have all these other exchanges where the exact same thing is taking place as the wife-sister motif. It's a common theme that they're presenting and probably traced back to some sort of oral tradition that has been morphed into these various different accounts that we find in the Bible.
All right. Okay, we have about 45 minutes left, and I definitely want to do Sarah being barren, giving Hagar to Abraham, and sort of all the tensions and things like that, and then we want to get to the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. So we've got, let's go 15 minutes on this first one. Tell us about the seed is a covenant frustration, David, right? Where Sarah is barren and pick us up in the Genesis text on the solution to that.
Okay. So here's an instance then in chapter 16 where we see, you know, a covenant renewal, and it's an instance where Sarai is going to take matters into her own hands, right? She's going to give her handmaiden Hagar to Abram as his wife, as a concubine, a lesser wife of a lesser status, and then ultimately Ishmael will be born, who is attributed then as the father of the Arab nation. So this prepares us then ultimately for not only the origins of those people, but ultimately that cyclical pattern of covenant frustration, because Ishmael is going to be driven out and from the family in a terrible episode, but nonetheless a sacrifice type experience. And scholars have pointed out there are a lot of thematic connections then between Ishmael's expulsion and in chapter 21, and then subsequently with chapter 22, the Akedah, or the binding of Isaac. So it really can be interpreted as a sacrifice of both sons, if you
okay.
will.
Well, okay, so do the storyline, though, quickly. So she's barren. Sarah says, take Hagar, concubine, and at least you'll have some children. And then, so mm-hmm. then take us through her, you know, the laughing and all that, and her having her own kids, and then the tensions that started to show up.
Okay, so we'll jump then to chapter 21 to pick that up. In verse 1, we read that the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, he promises. Remember, he pays a visit to Abram in the tent. Abram shows his hospitality welcomes God into this tent, and God gives him the promise that you're going to have a child, and he, this one, will be the fulfillment of this promise that I've made of land and seed. And this will be the birth of Isaac. Now, chapter 21, then we read the Lord again visited Sarah. The language is very interesting because of the really direct way that Yahweh, God, is involved with the procreative act. It reminds readers of what we saw in Genesis chapter 4, verse 1, where Eve states, you know, that I have procreated a man with Yahweh. So Yahweh is a deity who is directly involved with the fertility process, with procreation, and the sacred power of begetting life in the J source. And we read that he did, you know, very active verb, unto Sarah as he had spoken. Sarah conceives, bears Abraham a son in his old age, and this will be Isaac in chapter 21. And then the covenant frustration, because we're all excited as readers. Finally, the story has a happy ending. And then we transition to chapter 22, where the same child then, Abraham now is given the commandment to kill him upon an altar.
Give me something on anybody, just on the Sarah-Hagar tension and how things shifted. Do you sense that there was tension all along? You know, yeah, she's doing it only because I can't do it. This sucks. I kind of hate her. I resent her. You know, read between the lines of what's going on, because she gets pretty mean, and a lot of people, you know, at least from the textual sources, a lot of people can't really humanize what's going on. I mean, I guess we could sort of understand it, but yeah, we think she's too extreme.
I wonder if maybe David or Tom could comment on, you know, Hagar's position in the family as I believe a concubine, is that right? So how did that work in terms of dynamics of the family?
She had fewer rights than Sarah would have had, you know, as a lowercase, you know, relationship.
So, yeah, lesser status, concubine. What about the status of Ishmael? Would he have had the rights before Isaac came along to inherit and do all the different things that kind of comes with firstborn?
Well, it's very difficult to say, and it gets back to the issue with Spicer, Dan, that you brought up. You know, traditionally, commentators will like to go and not only use ancient Near Eastern customs, laws, and traditions to interpret these narratives, these patriarchal stories in Genesis, but they'll also go back and then try to connect them with later biblical standards that we find in the covenant code in Exodus chapter 21 and in the Deuteronomic passages. But remember, these are all, you know, different sources that are coming to us. And so to what extent would they have had application in terms of the formation of these families and how they would have the dynamics and so forth? It's very difficult, I think, to put a definition on how they interacted and how they were interpreted, which is why scholars in recent years have kind of backed off saying, well, it's tough to say.
So would you, again, this is, again, it's tough to say, but would Abraham have been thinking that the covenant frustration of not having a child was ended through Ishmael?
I think that's a good reading that we could take. It's, you know, then we're jumping in and doing a psychoanalysis of this,
right,
of character. It's sure, at least, I don't know about if I can answer that as much as I can answer that we as readers approaching the narrative for the first time are probably meant to think that. I feel comfortable with that assertion.
Okay. So he's cruising along. No one's really expecting this visit from God to where Sarah's going to not be barren anymore. So Abraham's probably cool with what's happening here. This is how it's being fulfilled. Okay, so when things happen and things change, Sarah rushes Hagar out, and Ishmael is, you know, abandoned and stuff like that. I know, Brian, you're going to be able to bring a bunch of Muslim stuff in here. Is there anything in the text itself, David or Tom, that, like, gives us a hint about whether Sarai was being a total jerk here, or if she's just, you know, kind of, this is within her rights, as well as she's acting morally in the case of Hagar and Ishmael?
Well, I mean, again, interpreting it from an ancient Near Eastern perspective, I think an audience would have recognized that she's, as the first wife, is acting within her rights, culturally speaking. But I get the sense, Dan, that your question is based upon this view that we have as Latter-day Saints. we often want to look at these patriarchal and matriarchal figures of Genesis and view them as perfect individuals, ones who never make a mistake and err, and put them up on this high religious pedestal. But the account never does that, really. In fact, we're going to read about weaknesses, mistakes,
right,
problems that they make all throughout. And the classic illustration of that would be Isaac's son, Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel. Boy, he makes a lot of mistakes throughout his lifetime and has the name change. But even then, as we transition into the Joseph narrative and get the focus there, we read that that Jacob loved Joseph more than all his other sons.
Right, right.
And part of that love leads to their jealousy. And so, in a way, the narrative is kind of saying, look, here's what happens when people have favoritism. Here's what happens when they make mistakes. The biblical authors are not afraid to point out, characters acting selfishly, characters acting with all, from a problematic moral perspective and making mistakes, which is different than the way I think in our tradition we like to look at these heroes from the past.
And Brian, help us. I bet the Muslims are even more extreme from what you've told us so far anyway.
They pretty much make Hagar the hero of the story, certainly.
Right.
She's a prominent factor in the Hajj, the pilgrimage Muslims try to make in their life if they
this
can.
This is where they run back and forth between the pillars and stuff. Yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. Between the two mountains.
For the mountain. That's right. The two mountains in this case. Yeah.
It's all underground. It's all underground now. There's a big hallway between these two mountains underground, or not really underground, but in a building, I should say. But maybe underground too. I can't remember. But anyway, and how Hagar went back and forth between Safa and Marwa, those two mounts, to try and find water for Ishmael. And then how she miraculously finds that and this kind of thing. And they've got, a well over there that they think is the well that has that water. And so that water has special powers of blessing, these kinds of things. And of course, Abraham figures prominently into the pilgrimage for Muslims, very much so, because Abraham is the one that is looked at as the restorer of the pilgrimage in his day. And that gets passed all the way down to Muhammad, and where he kind of reinitiates all of that in his day, and supposedly all the way down to our day. Of course, there's been changes in these kinds of things, but the general structure of the pilgrimage is a reenactment of a lot of what's going on here in Genesis through the lens of the Quran and the Hadith and Muslim eyes, these kinds of things. And so, yeah, Hagar's she's the hero of the story, though. They don't even hardly talk about Sarah. So
okay, but for them, Sarah would have been the villain here. She was acting improperly.
Exactly. And,
she's the oppressor to the hero. The heroine.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So good. And then we'll have Isaac show up in the Akedah here in a minute when we talk to that. Is there anything more on this Sarah, Hagar, Ishmael, Isaac stuff you guys want to mention before we go to the binding?
I'm just wondering, with Sarah being the first wife, is that, we have this reference in DNC 132 to the law of Sarah. And David, what do you make of that in terms of the text here? Is there any connection you're seeing or anything going on? Is that related only to plural marriage? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, that's my sense, Brian. It's an interesting connection. I mean, our audience is definitely going to want to take a look at the imagery in terms of the patriarchal covenant, the promises that are identified in Doctrine and Covenant section 132, which, as you mentioned, are often tied in with the law of Sarah and ultimately plural marriage and eternal increase. What to do with that in terms of linking that directly into the narrative of the Bible, I'm not sure, though.
Tom, are you up on what they're talking about here? And is there anything wider Christian stuff that at play?
I believe, you know, I'm tracking okay. Yeah, with the Doctrine and Covenants and so on. I remember early on in my LDS visitations, that being, you know, paid attention to, you know, that there was Abraham and there was Hagar and, you know, that there was a plural marriage there. And of course, Spicer and others who talk about, you know, was she a sister and a sister wife and all this idea that Israel had, you know, five statuses of wives and things like that. I don't really know. We just tend to look at this in general Christian circles and feel, you know, the blessing went through Sarah, you know, because of the expansion of the kingdom, and we kind of leave off in Christian tradition the blessings that were to go to Ishmael and that came out of Hagar in Genesis 16. And so it seems like all of us kind of read these texts a little bit lopsided, don't we? We emphasize some things and not others, omit other pieces of the story in favor of the blessing of others.
Awesome. My one hanging thing is, what became of Hagar and Ishmael in the wider Judeo-Christian stuff versus how they obviously, you know, lived on and whatnot and became prominent in Islam? So what's the wider story of after they're thrown out, what happens with them?
Well, in Christian tradition, you really do see Ishmael as a type of a villain, you know. You really see the idea that the blessing, you know, was not with him. In fact, you'll even hear a lot of Christian commentators say, well, he was a wild ass of a man, you know. And they forget that there is broader definitions there, that men become nations and types and things in Jewish theology. And we also forget, as I said earlier, that there were blessings to be given. And it's interesting, we have an early patristic source in early Christianity that said through the Messiah that we were, as the people of God, to restore the blessings to Ishmael and later through Aram and other blessings through the Christian gospel to both sides of the covenant. And isn't that interesting? We've never really pursued that.
Yeah. Okay, so the tradition is that Ishmael becomes the father of the Arab peoples, right? Is that
well, he has 12 princes.
Well, Aram.
Yes,
but that's the son of Shem. Aram becomes the Arab people.
Right, but Ishmael had 12 sons, 12 princes.
That's right.
And which is interesting as a counterpart to.
To Abraham, yeah.
Yeah, to Israel having 12.
Yeah, Israel 12 sons. Yeah, Jacob.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's, and Brian, you've kind of shared with us that the Quran, you know, does these retellings and whatnot. Is there any wider, besides the Quran and it, you know, someone could look and say, oh, they're deliberately trying to draw the parallels here. Was there anything wider, deeper, earlier than what you get in 600 with the beginning of the recitation of the Quran that would have, you know, kind of given evidence to him having 12, et cetera?
Well, the 12, of course, just comes through the biblical text. That's where we get that.
Oh, okay. I wasn't aware of that. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. And so, of course, not right off the top of my head can I give you the reference to that, but it's there, and they're all named and such.
Right.
So that's already there. And, of course, in the early Islamic period, there's a lot of interplay between the Arabs and the Jews going on. There was even the Bible was in Arabic for at least the Arabs who were Christian back in those days. So there's a lot of interplay between those two.
Cool. All right. Well, let's let's leave this story and go to the key one, the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. David, give us a quick etymology of the term Akedah and tell us the story however you'd like, and then we'll start talking about all the commentaries on it.
Okay, sure. So in Judaism, the story that is told to us of the sacrifice of Isaac in Genesis chapter 22 is known as the Akedah, which means binding. It actually stems from Genesis chapter 22, verse 9, where we read that that Abraham bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar upon the wood. We can actually maybe give our audience a little bit more background on the text in light of something that I hinted at and that Tom also hinted towards this direction, and that is the connection with chapter 21. I think it's nice to read the two texts. They stem from different biblical sources, but ultimately been brought together by an editor, and now synchronically, we can read it in a way that Ishmael is a sacrificed chosen son, just as Isaac is. Both of these sons are important to deity, and he has a mission for them, if you will. I think that makes it a little bit more palatable for a religious devotional audience. And the connections that I'm pointing out, Genesis chapter 21, there are things like we read, verse 14, Genesis chapter 21, that Abraham rose up early in the morning and took bread and a bottle of water, and he gave it unto Hagar, putting it on her shoulder. And that can be connected with Genesis chapter 22, when Abraham has to sacrifice the second son. Notice the connection of vocabulary. Abraham, verse 3, rose up early in the morning. So you have the rose up early in the morning motif, saddled his donkey, and took. So you have the same connections. And just as then Hagar puts on her shoulder the things that are going to lead to her demise and sacrifice, so then the son, Isaac, puts the wood for the burnt offering upon himself eventually. Returning to chapter 21, at the end of that verse 14, we have a reference to the location Beersheba, which ties in from a literary perspective to the conclusion of the Akedah, verse 19, where they will go both of them together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt in Beersheba. So we're linking the narratives together. So verse 19, God opened her, Hagar's eyes, and she saw the means of her deliverance, a well of water. Connects then with Genesis chapter 22, verse 13, where Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and he sees the means of deliverance for this son, Isaac. And so what we're seeing here, there are other connections that could be drawn together, but ultimately when we put these two accounts as together as a unit, we seem to see that Ishmael is a chosen son. It is a sacrifice for his father, as is Isaac, and that God has a plan in mind and a destiny for both of these two boys.
Awesome.
Yes, David, that is really cool.
Wonderfully connected.
Now, Tom, you had mentioned this tie before, to expand on it.
Yeah, the verse I was going to jump back to, and I'd love to hear what the team says about this, was chapter 21, verse 22. It says, now it came at that time, Abimelech, and it talks about the commander of the army, saying to Abraham that God is with you in all that you will do. That seems to be some of the lessons that are going on here, doesn't it? Some scholars have wondered if the binding of Isaac and later the sacrifice and all through this story, did God actually tell Abraham to do the wrong thing? Others view it back to 22 verse 1, that there was a test there that was going on. And it seems to be feeding off this verse that God was with them the entire time, whether Abraham properly understood the message, when it came down to the binding and the sacrifice and things later, that the Lord will provide one, which we'll get to later. It seems to be feeding off of this particular verse that God seems to be with them, not letting the story get out of hand all through the narrative.
Interesting.
I would love it if what David and Tom were saying would get out more amongst us Latter-day Saints, because Ishmael takes the Ishmael and the Arabs take a hit in the LDS church sometimes. I'm sorry, but they do.
Yeah, and so does Esau. You know, yes, you have the does. One thing of, you have the whole thing like, oh, I don't care about my birthright, and we just make him this bad guy. He became a great guy with a great big family and very successful. And,
exactly.
You know, and he had the most forgiving heart. He's the one that forgave his brother after all the wrongs.
See what a bowl of pottage can do for you?
That's right. But anyway, yeah, you're right. Well, that's great. I'm glad you brought that up, Brian, because, yeah, there's a lot of redemption of characters that are needed, aren't there, in some ways. You get you can't take just a slice of life and treat that as the whole thing.
So David was...
We create a canon within the canon, as James Sanders so beautifully put it.
Nice.
So, David, was that from two different sources there, like J&P?
Yes, that's the thing. They're two different sources, documentary sources. But we're still okay, I think, to make this sort of connection because, you know, as much emphasis as I give to documentary analysis, and I think it's important that we recognize it and we analyze it from that perspective, we have to acknowledge that ultimately the text has been brought together as a synchronic whole. And whoever put the sources together wants us to read the narrative this way. And so scholars refer to that sort of analysis typically as redactional criticism.
Right.
You know, what does the redactor, what does the editor want us to take by putting the narratives together in the way that he has?
And allowing that he changed some of the narratives probably from
original. Definitely.
Yeah, right.
And isn't it fair to say, gentlemen, that that's part of the reason we have tension in the narratives is because the different sources that are welded together creating a new structure.
Definitely.
Often, yep.
Definitely. That's for sure. Absolutely. That's very well said, Tom.
Okay, well, we need to get in. So I think everyone knows the basics of the Binding of Isaac story, and we get to the altar. Is there anything in the story you guys want, you know, before the God or the angel stays Abraham's hand? Is there anything you guys want to tell about the story that's interesting before we get into this, like, how did Abraham act morally, you know, that kind of thing, ethically, you know, that whole obedience and all that kind of stuff. So is there anything in the story itself before we kind of get into all the various interpretations?
Yeah, I'll just share that, speaking personally, that Genesis chapter 22 for many, many years has been just an academic interest and focus of mine. I've spent... I mean, with the grammar, the context, it's really one of my favorite stories, as difficult as it is theologically. So there's so much to share. I guess we could just jump right into some of the, you know, specifics that I find that I'll share that I think are really exciting to recognize. Chapter 22, verse 2, we read in the King James, "Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest." And we talked about this in a previous episode that, you know, here you have an intensification through groups of three, right? Just like Noah, for instance, was described as being he was righteous, he was blameless in Hebrew, and then he walked with God, that intensification. That's what's going on here in verse 2. It's building up the drama. Take your son, which is very difficult for him, but it's even more difficult than that. Take the one you love, your only son, the Isaac whom you love. And see, the intensification actually then parallels the beginning of the Abraham narrative in chapter 12, verse 1, where Abraham has to make a serious sacrifice, leave your land, your kindred, your father's house. So it's a very intense sacrifice built upon these groups of three. And then we read, "Go to the land of Moriah and offer him upon one of the mountains that I will show you." So Abraham gets up in the morning. There's no reference in the narrative to what to his response. You see, we as readers have to fill in the blanks. And he gets up in the morning, and then he saddles his donkey. Then look sequentially at the actions, he takes his two young men with him, and he takes Isaac, his son. Then he chops the wood for the burnt offering, and then he takes off and he leaves. Sequentially, it's all out of order because the poor donkey is standing there the whole time waiting for Abraham to go get his servants, to go get his son, and it's not the order that someone would normally do things if they're thinking clearly. And the rabbis, of course, picked up on this in their commentaries and said, you know, this is clearly Abraham struggling. He's trying to figure it out. Perhaps he just, you know, he's clearly upset over what's going on, because it'd be the equivalent of of getting up in the morning, going up and starting my car, coming back in, eating breakfast, and then going back out and leaving, right? Nice. That you're distracted. And, and then returning to the idea, we see that also with what King James translates as clave or to chop. It's actually from a verbal structure in Hebrew, binyan, to throw that term out there, that is incredibly violent in its nuance. It's not just he chopped the wood. It's more that he smashes it to pieces.
Wow.
He smashes the wood for the burnt offering, and he goes to the place which God has commanded him. And the other thing to note there that's interesting in verse 3 is that the author does something fascinating. He doesn't just call Isaac Isaac. He calls him Isaac, his son. And I think that, well, I know that's very significant, because remember, biblical authors don't throw out extra literary elements, descriptive components, just to paint a picture in our mind's image. There's a reason for this redundancy and repetition. And I like to give the comparison then with Eve. I ask my students, what did Eve look like? Did she have brown hair or red hair, blue eyes, pink eyes, purple skin? Was she thin? Was she homely? What did she look like? And of course, the account provides no indication of what she looked like physically. And I point out, do you know how incredible that is to not describe the physical features of a woman? In the history of world literature, women always appear as the victim of the male eye, even in fairy tales. But it's just totally irrelevant, so the author is going to skip that detail. And yet, here you have a tradition where we as readers already know who Isaac is. And yet the author goes to great lengths to remind us he took Isaac, his son. And that pattern continues throughout the entire narrative because, for example, we read, verse 6, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, he laid it upon Isaac, his son. And then verse 7, and Isaac spake unto Abraham, his father. You see, based upon the pattern literary pattern that we see throughout Genesis, we wouldn't expect these extra elements. But even though Abraham seems to be distancing himself perhaps from Isaac in preparation to make the sacrifice, we see that, for example, by the fact that when he describes Isaac in verse 5, the King James says, look, the lad and I will go yonder. He uses the term na'ar, which means servant. The servant and I will go yonder and worship. And it's the same term that, by the way, describes the unnamed servants earlier in the account.
Wow.
So perhaps Abraham is distancing himself emotionally from the child in preparation for the sacrifice. But if that's the case, the narrator is not going to allow us as readers the same privilege. So he'll never miss an opportunity to remind us Abraham is father, Isaac is son. Father, son, father, son. And you get that again in verse 9. Abraham built an altar there. He laid the wood in order. He bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And he stretches forth his hand. So this is an incredibly dramatic tale that's so powerful and has left an imprint upon religious readers all throughout history.
Okay.
But let me just add then verse 5 is interesting in light of a question that you asked, what's going on here theologically. Remember that Abraham says, the lad, the servant, and I will go yonder, we will worship, we will come again to you, which is interesting. And a lot of trees have been wasted, over trying to argue, did Abraham lie to the servants? What is he doing? And I say wasted because that argument is all based upon an improper understanding of Hebrew. Because the form there that is translated in King James, we will come again to you, is technically known as a cohortative. And I don't want to be too technical, but the cohortative in biblical Hebrew is a first person form that expresses a wish or a desire. So a more appropriate translation really is, and hopefully, we will return to you.
Nice. Wow, there is so much more going on, isn't there?
Yeah.
And the you there, David, is he talking to who's he talking to there, David?
Yes, he's talking to the servants.
Okay. The other two
that are called the same exact term, na'ar, that Isaac is called here. The servants, he says, hopefully we will return to you.
Yeah. And Brian, I want to fold you in because I know you have to go in a few minutes, but just one quick commentary. It says lad here. There's somehow it seems like, I don't know if it's Mormonism or wider world, there's a big idea that Isaac is a full-grown man at this point. He's not a young person. Is that attested to wider, or is that just a Mormon thing?
No. There is Jewish legends that have him as an older person, not as, and some that like to have the, you know, the more Christological connection will have him right at about 30.
Yeah, that's what. 33
or whatever.
Definitely, I hear that. Yeah, and so in other words, this problem with lad being translated, or you know, being the author saying lad, or the translators here saying lad here versus servants, you kind of get the impression that the other servants are probably grown men. Therefore, it's more likely that Isaac was a grown man too.
If it's the same. And implying that he had a choice, that he, you know,
right.
he probably could have overcome his father physically, you know, this kind of thing, and run away if he wanted to, but he was obedient.
Yeah.
Again, this gets you back to where some people like to tie that into a kind of a typological thing for Christ.
Not just some, a lot. People. for sure. Now, Brian, I know you've got to go in 7 or 8 minutes, so I wanted to make sure that before we get too farther into the story that you kind of have your say. Not only, I'd love the Islamic pieces of this, with this becoming Ishmael instead of things, and then just any of your theological takes that you can kind of force, you know, for when we get into that, we'll at least have you on record.
Right. In Islam, of course, the focus is on Ishmael, not Isaac. But interestingly, probably within, you know, maybe the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries there was actually a lot of debate between Muslims about whether it was Isaac or Ishmael. You can actually find sources from those time periods that have it as Isaac and not Ishmael.
Hmm.
And so they actually had to kind of work that out. And that the reason for that is that the Quran doesn't say who it was. It just says his son. It doesn't name it.
Wow.
And so that left them in a quandary as to, well, who are we talking about here, you know? And so, of course, Ishmael does win out, and it's Ishmael now without any question. But when you go back to those earlier sources, you can see the debate going on.
Fascinating.
That in itself is interesting. They also have, but they follow along the same general lines as the Jewish Midrashic sources do, you know, that he's a lad, maybe a little older, but they also fold in some of the travels that Ishmael had with Abraham before the sacrifice, where they go to Mecca and they rebuild the Kaaba area and this kind of thing before they ever get up back into Jerusalem. You know, the Dome of the Rock, of course,
right.
Jerusalem is where Abraham is said to have had almost sacrificed Ishmael.
Right.
And so all that plays into Islam very, very centrally. Abraham is a central figure. In fact, some sources say that Muhammad liked to compare himself to Abraham because he felt like his life was sort of a pattern of Abraham's. And so this is stuff I did my dissertation on. So if I'm saying too much, you can cut this out. But
no, I knew the connection with the Dome of the Rock, and I was going to get to that when you said there was a dispute. But yeah, it's definitely won out because that's the most contested real estate in the world, and that particular spot where the Temple Mount and all that stuff is huge.
Location, location, location.
That's right. But Isaac's the hero here with Muslims. That's the bottom line. Isaac and Hagar are Ishmael.
Yeah.
Yes. Ishmael and Hagar are the heroes of the Muslim story, and Isaac and Sarah sort of recede into the background a little bit more.
Right, for sure. So now give me the theological takes on, is this a test for Abraham? Was he acting moral? You know, give me Islamic stuff, and then I want your, like, what do you say when you teach LDS audiences?
Well, this is the ultimate moral dilemma, I guess.
For sure.
A paradox tour de force, you know. I mean, it's amazingly intense to ask a father to sacrifice his only son or a son. And what kind of a moral would that it just doesn't, you know, there's, you can't comprehend that in terms of moral issues. And so when I talk to students about it, you know, we have to kind of talk through, you know, well, what do we mean when we say that we have to go through the, you know, quote unquote, Abrahamic test? Are we talking about that we have to go through some sort of a test akin to Abraham sacrificing his son, some sort of a moral paradox there? I mean, is that what we've got to do? Or is it just this constant frustration that Abraham has to go through to realize and renew and such the covenant? And so it's more of an enduring type thing. Is that the test? It's not an easy question to answer, actually, because if you're going to focus on the sacrifice, the Akedah, that brings up some huge issues there on, you know, what does that mean for each of us in our lives that we have to go through some sort of a moral dilemma like that? Or is it just all the little moral dilemmas that we go through and make our choices in terms of what we're going to, you know, good over evil, these kinds of things? So it's difficult. I have not totally resolved that. Maybe the other two members have, but I have not.
So when you teach it, though, you put it in terms of, you offer the full range of options, you would say, rather than narrow in on any one thing, that I don't think it's this big gesture like killing your son. Because obviously mentally ill people have taken this, absolutely, you know, as this is what I'm called to do. And yeah, we want to steer away from that.
No, I give it a range there. I go through those range of options there. No. Yeah, we know that in our Utah history here, we've had some crazy people do things based on this, and so taking it way too literally.
Okay. Well, I'm going to thank you for being with us today, if you truly have to go right now, which is...
Yeah, I do.
Well, thank you. We've loved having you, and we hope that you'll listen to the last part and weigh in on the blog when we're done and up. So thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you for having me, and take care, David and Tom.
Thanks, Brian.
Always a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
All right, guys, is there anything more, David? I know you're excited about chapter 22, so is there anything else you wanted to bring up other than let's start moving into theological options and the history of interpretation and stuff like that?
Well, so you picked up on that excitement then, huh?
Yeah, and it was so fascinating. You only got through verse 5.
I know. It's like I said, I have a love-hate relationship with this story. We can get that in a second, but I'll just add in that, so verse 6 then, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, he laid it upon Isaac, his son. He took the fire in his hand, in his own hand. It's interesting. He takes the fire and a knife. So the objects that are most frightening, if you will, to this person in this circumstance, he still carries that, puts it in his own hand. And we read that they went both of them together. So talking about the unity that they experience right here, father and son, a line that will be repeated later in the narrative as we move forward. But then transitioning to verse 7, Isaac spake unto Abram, and he said, my father. Which is beautiful, because in Hebrew it's not separated. The pronoun my and father are not separated into two separate words as they are in English. It's one word, avi, in Hebrew. It's ab plus the first person common singular pronominal suffix my, to be technical on it. And what that means in biblical Hebrew is the same thing that it is, you know, it means in contemporary Hebrew. It means papa or daddy. It's a term of endearment when we say my father. So, you know, daddy, papa. And then he answers, here I am, my son. So then we read, behold, the fire, the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And that Hebrew word translated as behold in the King James text is technically a presentative. And what that means is it presents new information as we transition as readers from the perspective of the omniscient narrator to the characters within the text. So now we transition with the word behold right to Isaac's perspective. We could therefore render it in a sense, I've just noticed, or I've just seen, right, the fire, the wood, but daddy, where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And then Abraham said, my son, God will provide. And now we return in verse 8. So the two of them went, both of them together, right? Repetition of that phrase. And then it came verse 9. They came to the place which God had told him of. And by the way, that place, makom in Hebrew, has cultic signification in Hebrew. Place is typically used for a temple center, and this is, of course, connected with Mount Moriah and the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and in Christianity will be linked, the Christological connections will be linked ultimately with the mountain range where Christ himself will be offered. God had told him of, continue with the text, Abraham built an altar there, he laid the wood in order, bound, there's our term, Akedah, Isaac his son. Then we read, Abraham stretched forth his hand, and it's so quick in Hebrew, the verbs, that it's we're reading it, and it's so dramatic. He took the knife to slay his son. And then at the very last moment, the angel of the Lord called to him out of heaven, and he said, Abraham, Abraham. Notice the immediate repetition of his name. Abraham repeated twice in verse 11 when the divinity calls out from heaven, as in contrast to what sets Abraham on this initial journey in verse 1, where we just read that God said, Abraham, and he said, here am I. See, the immediate repetition of Abraham, Abraham, in contrast to verse 1 when the initial call is given, shows us that this is at the very last moment. God intervenes and says, do not lay your hand upon the lad. And now I know that you fear God and you will receive this blessing. They see the lamb, the means of deliverance, and then Abraham is given this incredible blessing. Verse 17, your seed will be as the stars of heaven, which has interesting implications as we've hinted at.
Awesome. That's fun to add that drama there. It looks like our action film directors have, with the last minute, the wire is clipped to stop the bomb. I guess there's precedent here from the Bible. That's funny.
The guy's about ready to be taken out at San Quentin or something, and the switch is pulled down, and they're waiting for the phone call, you know.
Right, exactly.
Will it be more power to you, or will it be, you know, a stop sentence, you know?
Yeah, yep. Okay, well, thank you, David. That's great to have that extra stuff for the narrative itself. Let's do history of theological interpretation on this, and then the Christian and the Mormon, what do we all do with this? So, Tom, why don't you just start riffing a little bit on, is it a love-hate it's probably a love-hate relationship with the text, like David talked about, pretty much for every human being, and I'm certain wider than Mormonism.
Well, it is, because, you know, how could Yahweh, you know, ask Abraham to do something, you know, with the violence, you know, that's in the text, and then, you know, testing like that, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's about to play out, and boom, you know, I think we all struggle with this, but we do take away the notion that Abraham was indeed willing to do what he felt Yahweh asking to do. You know, when it was time to depart, you know, Abraham would do this. It was time to go into Egypt, Abraham would do it. If it would sacrifice, you know, on Mount Moriah, well, you know, Abraham would do that. So we kind of take from this in Christian tradition that Abraham had faith, and Abraham departed and was willing to be moved, you know, by God. Now, whether or not it's that simple or not, I rather doubt. You know, I think there's a lot more struggle going on in Abraham as he does these things, you know, rather than when you just read the King James Bible, you know, God said it and Abraham just, you know, went right out and did it. But there's also the sacrificial aspect that you brought up earlier, Dan, that makes this significant. Mount Moriah was significant. We see this in the book of Genesis, you know, because of Jerusalem and the temple and the places that sacrifice of the heart is where Christian commentators obviously went with this later, you know, into the sacrifice of praise. And boy, the victory is here. evil triumphed over good and all of this. The birth of the Messiah, you know, comes out of this because of the final sacrifice. So we do a great job of spiritualizing the evidence because of the love-hate relationship with the text. We have never resolved that tension.
Right. And probably it's a good tension to force us into these larger questions. But yet I know it's such a repulsive text to so many people that have you found any apologetic that works for you that you let's say the Akedah was in the readings that you were going to do a sermon on or something. Where have you landed best yourself?
That good overcomes evil in the end, and that God will not let the situation get out of hand and go against his ultimate will is how I preach the text.
Okay, what about Kierkegaard? Kierkegaard has, for those who don't know, Fear and Trembling is his famous book where the Akedah is like, you know, pretty much the central story about this. And it's probably the most interesting take. My memory, I haven't studied it in more than 15, 20 years now, but my I think the key phrase is that Abraham acted ethically wrong, but morally right in this. And his larger argument is that Abraham was such a, it's almost like you can almost get a little spiritual development thing. At a certain point in our lives, we could develop to be so spiritually pure, so in tune with God, so kind of, the divine will and my will are the same, to where you're just so confident that you have this close relationship that in this case, it was appropriate for Abraham to do this. It wouldn't be for anybody else who hasn't arrived at this level of faith, trust, communion with God. Has that been something that, would you agree that that's certainly been one of the larger interpretations out there? What do you think of it?
Especially in the Catholic world, where you have people, going off to monasteries and things like that. That has been a text, that has been used to promote spiritual victory and moral purity in spite of the odds that may work against you.
So how is it used? I may be wrong. Where you drew the connection to going off to monasteries and being used? The way that it seems like Kierkegaard, or maybe it's just the commentaries, or just what swum in my head for the last 15, 20 years. It seems like it's almost like saying, it may not be the sacrifice of your child, but it may be whatever's the most important to you. Or there's going to be some point in your life where you're called to totally do something that would just be complete. So is that what you mean by going to monasteries?
Absolutely, and in our Catholic tradition. Yeah, in our Catholic tradition, that's sort of how you get the purity, to have that kind of spiritual commitment, is to be able to work through rites of priesthood, rites of maturity, that will test you, as you move forward, right down to your very core. As you become a nun or a priest or, a worker of God. And so I think in a spiritual sense, Kierkegaard is spot on with that from a personal sense.
Yeah, but again, with all the caveats that this is a truly disciplined person who's paid the price, who's lived with years of this communion with God to where something this type, this big could happen.
Yeah, in other words, God wouldn't give that sacrifice and test to just anybody.
Right. Good. Is there anything more you want to say? I want to pull David in with his favorite, what he's seen out there and different stuff too. But Tom, anything more?
I would love to just give one final quotation from Alcuin from the early church sources where he basically states that the Chaldeans, worshipped fire and that there's a meaning for the church, sort of that we weren't to give our sons to sacrifice, you know, through the fire, you know, and have them pass through the fire, because fire was one of the Chaldean gods, as he asserts. And our children were not to be sacrificed, as one of the stories of Abraham not being permitted to sacrifice his son. And I would love to learn from Brother David if there's any parallels we can extrapolate from his comments from the early church period.
Yeah, because you brought up the point I was definitely going to make sure, because some commentators are saying that the purpose of this is to show that child sacrifice, which has been happening, at least according to the biblical sources, this is kind of common practice. This is a story intended to, once and for all, put an end to that.
That's right, and that's exactly what his quote from Alcuin says.
Right. So, David, jump in.
Yes. It is interpreted oftentimes as an etiology, a story of origin on why child sacrifice was, you know, prohibited by God, his rejection of it, and this transition into animal sacrifice at the end. The problem with that analysis, though, is that the text really provides no indication that that's the purpose behind the narrative. And usually when the Bible wants to provide a story of etiology or an explanation, we get a, and therefore we see, sort of explanation.
Nice.
And there's nothing in it that hints in that direction. Now, you're certainly correct. We have in Leviticus 18, Deuteronomy 12, these laws prohibiting child sacrifice in Israel. But the archaeological evidence suggests that this, unfortunately, this tragic ritual performance was something that was done with some frequency amongst members of the indigenous population of Canaan. You know, even in, we see it in the book of Kings, right? 2 Kings 21, the story of Manasseh. And we read that he built altars and sacrificed his son upon these altars. So it is something that, clearly the Akedah is drawing upon this tradition of sacrificing the son. And yet, as an etiology for why that is not accepted by God, I don't think the text itself points in that direction. Instead, I think the objective, that the only thing that we can really identify, is that the story is written to explain why God favors Israel above other nations. Abraham did this incredibly difficult, dramatic sacrifice. And as a result, we read at the end of the account, in verse, you know, at the end of 22, this promise, verse 17, because you've done this, your seed is going to be like the stars, and they shall possess the gate of their enemies. So, and then the seed shall all nations of the earth be blessed, continuing on into verse 18. So I don't see the etiology for a rejection of child sacrifice here. What I see in the narrative is just simply an explanation for why Yahweh blessed and loved and chose to favor Israel, because this is a God, remember, that will give intergenerational blessings,
right,
but also intergenerational cursings. So that's how I see it.
Awesome.
That's certainly a better context for the information, rather than relying on sources that came, you know, hundreds and thousands of years later, projecting back onto it.
Yeah, that's a helpful comment. Yeah. David, when you teach it to your seminary students and your other forums, what do you teach about the Akedah?
Well, then we get back to my love-hate relationship. You picked up my passion for this narrative as literature, for what it's doing, the drama, the Hebrew, everything in it. It's one of my favorite stories from that perspective. I just think it's a powerful piece of literature. But the hate, although a strong term, I'm willing to throw that out because of, you know, it's so far, I detest the idea of God turning to a father and saying, kill your child. I mean, to me, that doesn't accord with my understanding and view of God. And I think that's part of the power, and Tom hinted in this theologically, as we bump up against that idea. So in other words, and I don't necessarily go into all this detail with a class, but I would talk about it from the perspective with our audience that, you know, just to be honest and open, as theology, as literature, there are things that I love. If this is a real story and it really did happen, then I hate it.
Okay, nice.
I'll just be honest with that. But where I'm not alone, and boy, there's a contradiction here, right? Because on the one hand, God says, Isaac is going to be your chosen son, and then he turns around and he says, kill him. And Abram has to face this contradiction, this moral dilemma. And I like to link it with, for students, I like to link it with the lectures on faith. Lecture on Faith 5, number 2, makes right. the statement that Jesus Christ himself was exposed to more powerful contradictions than any man can be, and yet remained true and faithful. And so Abraham faces this contradiction. He remains true and faithful. And certainly we face it, not only in trying to make sense of this terror text, because that's what it is ultimately, of, you know, is this right? Is it morally okay? But what about, would God really act that way? I mean, the contradictions that we face as readers are very intense. So, but not only do we face that there, Dan, but of course, we face that in terms of our everyday experiences with divinity. There's no question. Or even from the audience's perspective, you know, I'm sure they've bumped up against, and we only just scratched the surface, with the contradiction between the book of Abraham and its connection with the Egyptian papyri, or better yet, perhaps lack of connection from an academic perspective with that, and versus this scriptural text that we have. And looking at, and we've also hinted at Joseph Smith and his practice of plural marriage. My heavens, if we look at that, it's going to be very hard to reconcile with some of our own senses, our own sense of morality and the right behavior. But that's part of the power of addressing these sorts of things spiritually and critically. We're faced with contradictions. We as individuals have to come to terms with our relationship with God, our relationship with Scripture, our relationship then with church history, which is always messy. And as we face these contradictions and yet choose to remain spiritually true to our testimony, to our Savior, to God, we grow spiritually. We grow spiritually by facing and overcoming contradictions. So I guess that's how I would use it.
Wow. It's interesting. Hugh Nibley actually quoted a source, and he didn't side with this exegetically because it can't be done. But he cited the lion couch and some other Egyptian and Middle Eastern stories that tended to indicate in this type of tension that other gods were listened to, and then Yahweh jumps in, you know, and says, no, I never wanted you to do this. This is what I wanted to have happen due to my earlier promises, as some of these alternate stories were spread throughout the ancient Near East. But then in our Bible, we've got God doing all of this. My professor, Dr. Charles B. Dorothy from Claremont, made the observation that in ancient Hebrew society, you could say, well, you were a human sacrificer, or you put people through the fire like children in the Chaldean sense, or became, in his interpretation, more of a widespread accusation and a put down, which was stronger than the actual archaeology supported. So in other words, it was talked about in the biblical narrative, but the actual proof of it archaeologically wasn't as strong. And doesn't that kind of, Brother David, feed off what you were saying earlier?
I think it does, yes. And those narratives, I think that you've hinted at, or you've talked to us about, Tom, reflect the fact that we as modern readers are not alone in struggling with making sense of this text in light of our own feelings about divinity.
Yeah. Now, David, when you said, I'm not sure I'd say this to the young people, but I'll say it here to this audience stuff, was the part about, in terms of, I hate this text of the idea if it's a real story and God really did command it. Yeah. I can see saying that in an LDS setting and you know, mostly having everybody go, yay. But yeah. Have you done it? Or is this really the line that you would draw where, depending on my I certainly wouldn't do it with a young audience, but I might do it with an older one, or just a number more?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that I've ever been that open in an official teaching context, in gospel doctrine or Sunday school or anything like that, you know, acknowledging my passionate feelings on it. Uh-huh. Yeah, so
I may try it in a few weeks. We'll see.
Yeah.
Whenever we get to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
How long do you want to live?
I just find people... You know, below the surface, they're wrestling a lot more than they let on in the typical Sunday school answers, you know, and I really think that would resonate and be okay and open up some things. So I may try it. We'll see.
Okay. And I'll follow you.
Well, I think Abraham struggled a lot with it too.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, David's stuff on the text there showed us there with not just chopping the wood, destroying the wood.
Exactly.
Interesting, yeah. Well, I'll just let me throw one extra, two extra things here. In one of my earlier podcasts, it was one of the most powerful ones we ever did. It was called the Abuse and Forgiveness Dilemma. Teresa Edmonds was one of our guests, and she says that she saw that Abraham, especially because of the Mormon idea, or the, you know, that's in the book of Abraham, that he was once an abused child so far that his father was willing to sacrifice him, you know, or have the priest of Elkanah sacrifice him on the altar. Here's Abraham living out the abuse cycle. As we know, that a lot of times abuse victims often perpetuate what happened to them as a child and stuff like that. And she said she found some comfort in that, and that somehow, I can't remember exactly how she made the connection here, but God stopping, you know, God intervening at the last minute with the angel and things like this was a moment for Abraham to wake up and say, you cannot repeat the patterns of your father. You have to become the new man. You have to become, you know, a different, you have to break this cycle. So I'll throw that out there. You guys can comment if you want.
That's definitely a liberational reading of the text, isn't it? And something sociologically, I think we can connect to it, but I'm kind of reminded of Phyllis Tribble's text of terror, you know, when I spoke to her about that, that there are issues in the ancient world. They simply did not see abuse along 21st century sociological lines. It never would have entered into their mind, you know, to talk about no spanking and, do you use corporal punishment and all the redemption sociologically? It's just not how they function. They had limited good that only the kings had, and the subjugation of people based on limited righteousness was more, I believe, their ethos was.
Right. And I'm sure Teresa isn't thinking that this interpretation is in the text and it lends itself. It was just for her and her own, you know, she's seeing it at that level.
Isn't that an excellent reader response that we can give the text, as long as we don't project too much back on it from our day?
Yeah. I was going to say, Dan, she's doing precisely what Nephi did with Hebrew Bible sources. She's likening the scriptures unto herself.
Nice.
And I think there's great power in that. And ultimately, that's why these texts are powerful spiritually. I mean, a person like myself that loves historical critical analysis, that's what I do academically, I still have to recognize that, as exciting as that is to me, the reason that these texts speak to people and have over the centuries is because of the type of reading that she just demonstrated, that a person's able to go in and liken it. And I think that's wonderful. I'm all in favor of that. I do believe that we should have both. And, you know, it's not an either or, that, you know, we should approach the text critically, seek to identify authorial intent. And once we've gone through that process, liken away, make application and go forward and try to make sense of the text as an inspiring source. Absolutely.
Awesome.
And in our tradition, that's the role of the homiletics professor or the preacher, you know, is to do exactly what Teresa did there and make it applicable so beautifully, as Brother David said, to a modern generation.
Yeah, with our our stuff. Good. The other one, I don't know if any of you guys have read the Chaim Potok books, the two books on Asher Lev. The first one is the famous one called My Name is Asher Lev, and then the second one is called The Gift of Asher Lev. Are you guys either of you familiar with it?
Familiar, but I haven't read them.
Yeah, well, let me just start out for audiences, and I don't want to give away this, but you know, one of the key things about the book My Name is Asher Lev is this famous painting that Asher Lev becomes this amazing artist, you know, beyond all explanation. He's just that talented and so big, and it kind of forces him to break out of his, you know, Hasidic Jewish community. But he has this painting that he talks about all along called The Brooklyn Crucifixion, and you finally learn towards the end what this is. Well, just to let you know, he has another painting that sort of the narrative device is in The Gift of Asher Lev, and he says, yeah, I'm the one for the controversial, just like he was controversial in The Brooklyn Crucifixion, you know, having Jews use the crucifixion symbol, you know, within something to say something about their life. The Gift of Asher Lev all focuses on a controversial painting he did of the Binding of Isaac and the Sacrifice of Isaac type stuff. So I won't give it away, but I found it to be a fantastic read, and it really forced me into this story in a new way. So I recommend The Gift of Asher Lev as well as My Name is Asher Lev. My Name is Asher Lev, everybody needs to read. That is like one of the best books ever. But The Gift of Asher Lev is lesser known, but it is about the Binding of Isaac. So, anything else, you guys, on this Abraham cycle that we've gotten through today?
We're going to see it repeat in Isaac and Jacob. And,
sure.
It will be interesting as we see this cycle be retold, how the fulfillments that lead into Genesis 49, especially from 37 to the end of the book, what will actually show how the nations in the Mediterranean are blessed due to the Abrahamic covenant.
Thank you. David?
No, I feel good about the conversation. I've learned from others, and it's been great to share.
I felt like the team was clicking today. We were just feeding off each other. We were kind of getting to our flow here. It was a really good episode, I thought. Well, definitely next time, listeners, I want to go back and pick up the Lot stuff and Sodom and Gomorrah and the visitors, and let's, you know, add some clarity to that. I don't know if that's going to be sufficient for one whole episode, but beyond that, we might begin to start in with the Isaac.
Oh, I can hardly wait for Genesis 18. That's why I kept trying to comment on it.
Okay. Well, we will feed in. So thank you, listeners, for hanging in there. I'm glad that you're enjoying this series. I get lots of good comments about it, and so I'm thrilled that it's connecting. Thank you, team, David and Tom, who are here, and Brian, who's not here anymore. You guys are so generous and just wonderful. And again, it just astounds me what you guys know and what's sitting in your heads. And so it's a thrill to be a bit of a midwife here and sort of launching you guys into the world in terms of just peeking in there a little bit and see all the stuff that's running around inside your heads and helping us through the process. So thank you.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Yep, and Tom. And Brian, who's no longer with us.
Listeners, thank you for your support of Mormon Matters. Please keep it up. I love any donations that can come to help keep me, allowing me to carve out the time here. We'll catch you all later and say cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
Yeah. All is well.